Okay. All right. How's everybody doing? Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to see everybody. Just it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Tammy Temijakovits, who is in Camp Stone, as you can possibly see. That's where she is teaching from. And she is the chair of the Tanakh Department. We're talking at SAR High School in Riverdale, the founding director of, what's it called? Makom B'Siach, and what's the first name? I can't see that here.
No, that's right. Makom B'Siach, you got it.
Makom B'Siach, okay. And the Immersive Adult Education Program for parents. She taught at the Wexner Heritage Program. She teaches at Yeshivat Chova VeTorah. She has a BA in English Literature from University of Pennsylvania, learned in Drisha. She's a Wexner Fellow, so it's a pleasure to welcome. It's been a while since we've had the pleasure to learn with her. She was supposed to teach on Thursday night, and then we all realized it was the night Pesach ended. So we thought that's probably not a great time for a shiur when Pesach ended 15 minutes earlier. So we're happy to have her back now. Bakasha, Dr. Tammy.
Amazing. So as you guys just heard, I'm at camp. I hope you can all see me. In camp, we don't spend much time indoors. We're outside unless it's raining or we're sleeping. So I thought I would give you a flavor of camp by you being able to sleep in the cabin behind me and the dim lighting. It's a gift that we give our children to be outside in nature. And this is not on this week's Parsha, but something I shared with my shiur this morning. As we begin the month of Elul and we begin to think about ways that we want to rejuvenate our relationship with Hashem and with each other. You know, being outside gives you a heads up. And there's so much feedback that we get from the natural world that helps us feel alive and aware of God's presence. So I hope I can give you some of that magic tonight from Camp Stone. Okay, so tonight we're going to be learning about Parshat Shoftim, just a kind, gentle, if anybody would like to share their screen. It's so nice to be able to see your faces. And I know the minhag is to write your questions in the chat. If it feels like I can stop to answer the question, I'll be very happy to do so while I'm teaching. And if not, I'll reserve some time at the end for comments. I'd love to hear your thoughts. This is more of a raising questions than a closing with answers. So Parshat Shoftim is a very full Parsha. It actually was difficult to decide which issue to choose from this week's Parsha. The Egla Arufa is a popular one, and that's at the very end of the Parsha, and I was tempted to talk about it. It's actually so relevant today. One of the kids here, one of the campers said, you know, there's no accountability anymore in the world, which was a depressing thing to hear, but they weren't wrong. We're living in a time with very little accountability. It's hard to feel a sense that when things go awry, they will be accounted for, and Egla Arufa really deals head on with that. But if you look at the Parsha as a whole, reading through section after section, we know that we are in the middle of, you know, Moshe's long speech, the speech where he's expressing his concerns, his, might I say, anxieties about saying goodbye to the people that he's been shepherding. And we get a window into the kinds of concerns that he has for this people when they will launch, when he won't be there anymore. And in my reading, this is one takeaway from the Parsha, is that many of the mitzvot in this week's Parsha, one way or another, engage with the concern of how to launch and situate a fledgling people who are entering into a land that is not empty, a land that is full of other cultures, other practices. And Moshe is concerned over and again throughout different mitzvot, giving the Jewish people direction as to how to create the people that they are, that they will be within the midst of another society. And we'll look at some examples of this as we move forward. I was just mentioning to Jay before the class began that I went on a trip this summer, a few weeks before I came to camp, to Mexico City. I had never been to Mexico. I went with my husband, who is a professor of Sephardic studies. So I had an inn. I definitely recommend if you're going to go to Mexico, go with a native speaker. There was not a lot of English around. But being in Mexico, or really, I think for a lot of us, when we travel outside the country, we're able to see things about ourselves and about the way that we live that we don't normally pay attention to because we're so enmeshed. And there's two things I noticed in Mexico that I'm bringing to the study of this week's Parsha. The first was looking at the Jewish community with whom I was blessed to spend a good amount of time in shul and actually at Shabbos meals, and noticing how the community in Mexico, in this place which felt so foreign to me, noticing how the Jews have made their home in this place, how they have managed to adapt features of the wider culture. Silly example, but for those of us who like to shop, I went into the Jewish store, the kosher store, and I noticed there were so many kosher versions of the street food that I had been seeing and smelling all throughout Mexico City. And it makes perfect sense. The Jews see it too. And they find ways to take, let's say, a pork rind product and make it out of corn. And then it looks like what everybody else is eating. That's an example of adaptation. We know if you go to Israel, the Jews coming in from all around the world, food is right there in your face as an example of ways in which we've absorbed from our cultures. And the other piece that I kept noticing in Mexico City, and again, this is because I was traveling with a historian, but when I was learning about how the Christian colonialists came in and destroyed a lot of the Aztec culture, which had been very prominent and very rich and very vibrant there for many hundreds of years, I learned that the Christians built their churches on the same spots. I see some nods, so you know this. I never knew this, but on the same spots where the temples had been. And the Aztec spiritual leaders told their people, you should go to those churches because then you'll still be in the spot which had been your holy place. I found that to be a really interesting story. Obviously, our story is different. I mean, if you go to Spain, there's shuls that turned into other kinds of places of worship. But this very idea, right, and I'm not comparing the Jews in this time in Dvarim to the colonialists, but they did compare themselves to the Jews, by the way, and thinking about what does it mean for your culture and your form of worship to be right up against, perhaps even on top of, in place of, alongside another form of worship. And that's really the concern that we see throughout this week's Parsha when it comes to the mitzvot directly that relate to idolatry. And that's going to be our subject tonight. But also in the mitzvot that are not talking about idolatry, but are talking about, let's say, the justice system, which is intricately connected to idolatry in the example in this week's Parsha of what happens if there's a person in your midst who starts worshiping idols. How do you deal with it? And you have to bring that person to the court, and the court has to decide that this person needs to be killed, and you have to go ahead and kill him, and you need to listen to your judges. So the judges are a part of, right, setting up this society. Within a society, the Jews need to learn to trust their own judgment system and to learn and to listen to and follow through on how the Batei Din are setting up shop, again, a society within a society. Now, before we look at the actual mitzvot, and it's really only two psukim in this very busy parsha, I want to just say a few words about Avodah Zarah, which are coming from me. And if you think otherwise, please write so in the chat. And we, if we have time, we can talk about it at the end. But I think that Avodah Zarah is like a big mystery to most of us. And when we think about, you know, korbanot, right, we have a lot of questions about, I hear groaning about it. How can we embrace them? They're so out of step with our modality. They're so central to the worship structure. Morally confusing, right? How do I think about it when I'm davening? But what about Avodah Zarah? We're not confused by it. We just feel generally like it's, we moved past it. Like it's not something we really need to think about. And honestly, when we go to museums and we see figurines and we see all kinds of amulets, I might be speaking for myself, but I often have a sense of moral smugness. Like that would never be a problem for me. I would never actually think that I am bowing down to that earthen clay item, right? But in reality, we just don't understand it. We don't really know what Avodah Zarah was all about. We don't understand the worldview. And so I would submit that when we see psukim, like the ones we're going to see tonight, that are so animated by and working so hard to distance us from the world of Avodah Zarah, I want to just submit that I feel humbled by it. I really don't get it. And I'm leaving that to the archaeologists and the historians to explain to us better what it meant to ancient peoples. But I think we need to bring that with us when we come to Moshe's anxieties and concerns about Avodah Zarah, that it's really far from us. It's far from our worldview. And it's a bit of a mystery. Okay, so last word of intro, and then we'll jump in. What we're looking at tonight is two examples from our Parsha, not of what Avodah Zarah really represented or meant, but we're looking at two mitzvot that reflect this larger matrix I was talking about of Moshe trying to help the Jewish people launch and situate themselves within another society, and the safeguards and the limitations that were hopefully set up in order to allow them to succeed at bringing this innovative new way of being, new way of constructing society, new way of worshiping God that was so different from everyone else. And yet, when we're honest, still partakes of the world in which it exists and flourishes. Okay, any questions or comments before we move on to the actual mitzvot? If so, put them in the chat. Okay. Let me see if I can put this into present mode. No, I think we're stuck with this. Can everybody see? Okay. So these are the two psukim. From, one second, I can't tell if you can see or not, because Ellen, I can see your face. Can you tell me, can you see it? Can you nod? Great. Okay. So the two mitzvot that I want to talk about with you tonight are the two mitzvot that show up very early on in the Parsha, right after the famous beginning of Shoftim v'Shotrim, and right after the famous pasuk of Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof. Parsha begins by talking about the justice system, which we mentioned, and setting up the expectation that part of what you will do is not just set up judges, but set up judges who won't accept bribes, and setting up judges who will enable you, leman tichyeh v'yarashta et ha'aretz. So again, the justice system is central to the success of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And then come these two psukim that I want to suggest are rather strange. The first pasuk is as follows. Lo titalecha ashera kol etz, etz al mizbach Hashem elokecha, asher ta'aselach. The translation here, which is not what every translation says, this one says, you shall not set up a sacred post, any kind of pole beside the altar of your God. We would have probably translated ashera and etz not as pole, but as tree. So that you may make. Okay. The first prohibition seems to be at this moment in time, just through reading the words, you're not allowed to plant any kind of tree near a mizbeach of God that you will make for yourself or that you may make. The second mitzvah, which follows, velo takim lecha matseva asher sanei Hashem elokecha. You also may not, in addition to planting a tree next to a mizbeach, you cannot set up a stone pillar. And here we're told why. In the first one, we're not. Because God hates that matzeva. Okay? So two mitzvot. One has a reason-ish, as the kids say. The first one does not have a reason. They come in quick succession. And they're followed by a third mitzvah, which is not exactly the same, but is sometimes grouped together by the parshanim. So let's read it. Lo tizbach l'Hashem elokecha shor vaseh, asher yebo mum kol davara, ki toavat Hashem elokecha hu. You cannot sacrifice any kind of animal that has a mum, because that is a toeva, that is abhorrent to God. Different than sane, but another very negative word, toeva, of course, repeats many, many times in Dvarim, and in this parsha as well. So these two mitzvot, these two prohibitions, there's lots to ask about them. The first question would have to do with the context. And if you have a Tanakh and you open up, you see that right immediately following these three psukim is that other mitzvah that I spoke about earlier of what happens if there is an individual in your community who starts to follow idolatry. How do you take care of that person? That word to'eva is going to show up in that section as well. And following that is another matter related to judgment. So the first question is about the placement. What are these doing here? Might have made more sense to have had a continuous section that has to do with justice, and lots of parshanim have suggested other places where these mitzvot would have fit much better. So that's question number one. Question number two, of course, is what's the concern? What's the concern? Lo titalacha ashera kol eitz. Now the word ashera means two different things in the Tanakh. It, of course, at some point refers to the Asherah, the goddess, or the trees that were associated with that particular form of worship, but not exclusively. And an Asherah is also a type of tree, an Asherah kol eitz. Why can't you plant a tree next to a mizbeach? And furthermore, why can't you put up a matzeva? Why is a matzeva something that God hates? So in the first part of this shiur, in our exploration here, we're going to be looking at a series of parshanim who, as I wrote here, defining the contours of the prohibitions. They're taking the mitzvah at face value and giving us, I think, an understanding of what is behind it, but keeping it in a very local, literal sense. You'll see what I mean when we get to the second part, which is going to take us in a different direction. The first source that we have here is Ramban. Ramban says as follows. You have the English there if you want to follow along. I'm going to read at first in the Hebrew. First thing the Ramban says is, Lo titalecha ashera, kol ilan hanatua al pitche beit elokim yikare ashera. So we said that already, but now he is saying it more clearly. We're talking about any tree, but a tree that's planted at the entrance of a house of God gets the name ashera. Now, why would a tree be planted at the entrance of a house of God? He offers two reasons. Ulai bavur shehu sanderech mar'eh oto la'am yikarechem. Maybe the tree was there to alert people passing by that there is a house of worship here. So it has to do, he quotes a pasuk from Tehillim that has a different meaning of the word, asherah. You see there in the English, ashurai, my step. So it's a kind of signal, a directional object. Yes, here, akatu shelo yita ilan etzal mizbeach Hashem lenoi. V'yachshov shu kavod v'hadar l'mizbeach Hashem. Right? The second reason in there, right, is that not just was it directional, but it was also beautiful. And so perhaps, as we're getting, not a Jew might want to do it because it seems like a good idea. But in the bold, we find out, V'yassaro to b'avur shehu minhag ovdei avodah zara latati lanot b'pichei b'tei avodah zara shalahem. A Jew cannot do that. Why? Even though it seems logical, it's beautiful. Trees are always nice for shade when people are coming. And yes, you imagine a much more wild landscape that is less tamed. And if you see a beautiful tree, you know that there's a place to be here. We're not allowed to do that precisely because that is what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah were doing. And while the tree itself is not necessarily, no indication in the Ramban that the tree itself is a form of worship. This is not a direct hit kind of isur. This is not saying you can't worship Avodah Zarah, but you can't even plant a tree near your place of worship, your bama, before there was centralized worship. Or perhaps we could imagine it would be for today, although it's not, right, next to our batei knesiot. We can't do that because it is similar to, it's too close to, it's adjacent to what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah were doing. And you see there in the end of that section, the bold again, v'afilu lo avda, over below ta'aseh on the tiata. There's no concern yet, even that you're going to be worshiping it. Of course, if you worshiped it, we know that that's an Isur. But just the act of planting it, according to the Ramban, he's there quoting Rashi, is enough to be over on this Isur. Okay. He mentions in that source, the pasuk from Shoftim of Gidon, where we see here, you have that they're underlined, v'et ha'asherah, asher alav tifrot, right, in the story with Gidon, when he was tearing down the idolatrous worship that was all around him, right? Of course, this is much further on in Jewish history when Moshe's concerns seem to have really come to fruition, and the Jews are living in a time where there's a fledgling, I used that word before, but now I mean in a different way, group of people who are holding on to the Mesorah. And Gidon, when he is summoned to be the Navi, now it's his job to really go in and tear down what had been built up all around him, the altar of Baal that belongs to your father. And in addition to the altar of the Baal, he also had to cut down the Asherah that was beside it. And the Chizkuni in the next source adds one more piece related to the Asherah. So far we've said that it's Asur because that's what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah did, and they did it for beauty and they did it for singling. And the Chizkuni adds one other element. He says, right? He says what we already learned, that it was a common practice for the pagans to do this, as we saw in the book of Judges. Like, nobody should see you going to that location. It's like married iron, and they might even think it's not you, the planter. It's somebody else coming by, and there's a third person who's watching. Should not think that that person is going, right? Like many steps removed, that person is going to worship an idol. Okay, that's the first of our mitzvot. And I think what we've seen so far is that the parshanim that we've seen are concerned with what I'm calling adjacent idolatry. It's not the thing itself, but again, in this worldview of Moshe trying to set them up for success, going into a place where they're going to see practices that are appealing and might even be, right, aesthetically appealing, they might be useful. There's a real concern that they won't imitate and won't act like those around them. And this is one of those mitzvot that's setting up a kind of barrier. Second one gets a little more complicated, and I'm wondering if anybody was thinking it when they were reading with me the pasuk about the matzeva. Because the matzeva, as we'll see in a moment in the Ramban, is something that we see all throughout the early books of the Chumash. There were lots of matzevot that were set up by our avot. And yet the pasuk that we read said, "V'lo takim lecha matzeva asher Sanei Hashem Elokecha." So Ramban and all the other Mefarshim have two problems to solve. The first one is, what is it about a matzeva that is so problematic for us to do? We could guess already that it's probably what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah were doing. And secondly, what does it mean, Asher Sanei, when we have it in our past? So let's see what Ramban says. V'lo takim lecha matzeva, matzevet even achat, lakriv aleha afilu l'shamayim. So he's defining a matzeva as one large stone. I saw in some commentators it was believed to be like a kneeling spot in front of the idol. But you can't set up the matzeva of one large stone, even if it was part of your worship l'shamayim. Asher sanei, this is actually still Lashon Rashi, mizbeach adama o mizbeach avanim, says Rashi, that Ramban is quoting, you Jews should set up an altar made from stones or an altar made from earth, but not a matzeva. It is detested by God because it specifically was the practice of the Knaanim. V'yafal pishai ta'ahuvalo bimei ha'avot, achshav sinaa me'achar sha'asuha elu chok la'avodah zarah. Says Rashi, okay, acknowledging what we just said, yes, it's true that the Avot set up many Matzevot. Remember when Avram is traveling around on his first journey and he seems to be setting up a Matzeva all over the land. One of the ways that he is claiming it, another way that he's spreading God's name. Yes, that was a beloved practice, not just accepted. It was Ahuva, says Rashi. But now that very same practice has become detested because it was taken over by, or, right, depends how you understand history, but it has become embraced by the pagans as essential to their practice. And so what once was part of our tradition is no longer acceptable to be done by Jews. Now, Ramban, I'm not going to read it, but in the next paragraph, he asks a very logical question. He says, well, if the Torah is prohibiting the Asherah and the Torah is prohibiting the Matzevah, because both of those were practices by the Kna'anim, okay, I can accept that. He says, but what I don't understand is the Kna'anim were also using altars. They were also using Mizbechot. And as we know, in Dvarim, not in this parsha, but in other parshiot, specifically, the Jews are commanded that when they go into the land of Israel and they find the Mizbechot and they find the Matzevot, they are supposed to destroy them. So why would it be that the Torah does not prohibit a use of a Mizbeach, right? And you see here, again, the dilemma or the tension that I put out in the beginning of setting up a new way of life, a new society, a new form of worship, not just within another society that has compelling practices all around it, but within a society and a form of worship that is not entirely different from what is around them. So to address this question, first Ramban says, well, maybe it could be that every place of worship for pagans had a matzeva and only some had mizbechot. So maybe that's why the Torah is harder on the Matzeva, but then he rejects that and he says, no, every single place had a Mizbeach, and you see here, right before the bold, I found this fascinating. Let's read from the beginning there, that last passage, V'hanir e'be'enai, that's where the Ramban always tells us his personal position. Ki hayu ha'kna'anim hashtufim ba'avodah zarah osim b'chol batei Eloheha Mizbeach. Lakriva lava korbanot. He says the truth is every single place had a mizbeach. The Kna'anim, you see that expression, hashtufim. They were immersed in, they were steeped in avodah zarah. Every single one had a mizbeach. Ve'even gdola mutzevet al petzach habayit la'amod aleha hakumrin. In addition to a mizbeach, every place also had a matzeva, and that's where the priests would stand. And thirdly, Ilan Natua Chutzala Lasher Derech Habayim Sham, right? So the two elements that we know of from our Sukkim, and the third, which he has now raised, the Gam Hayom Hanotzrim Osim Kain. You see that slip in? Ramban here, who's living in Christian Spain, he slips in that he knows, he's seen this practice. I'm not sure which one of the three he's referring to. I assume it's the Ilan, that this was also practiced by his fellow Christians, which is why he understands what he's reading in the parsha. He's filtering it through the experience of his surrounding practices. So why Aser two and not the other? Here's the bold. V'hinei Hashem ha'nichbad sanei uma'as kol ma'aseihem v'yasar ha'matzeva v'hashem. Asherah below hishir rak hamizbeach shuhut sorech hakorbanot asher hu yitbarech tziva bahem. So the Ramban says, the truth is, I guess I'm adding this into his words, but in an ideal world, God would have asered also the mizbeach if he's setting up a way of life and a way of worship that is supposed to be totally distinct from and deviating from, or really not a part of the worship around it, the Mizbeach also should have been on the chopping block, as it were. But it couldn't be because it was necessary for offering Korbanot. Now, you all remember the famous machloket between Rambam and Ramban on Korbanot. And Rambam takes the view of Korbanot in general as a concession to wean the people away from the practices that they had known prior to Sinai, to a place eventually where there would be no cultic worship. And Ramban, on the other side, in that argument, actually sees value to Korbanot and does not see Korbanot entirely as a concession. But here you get a whiff of that concession view in Ramban himself, where he seems to be suggesting that there are features of the Jewish worship which, right, need to be there for Tzorech Sha'ah. Okay. So now we understand, according to Ramban, both of our mitzvot, we understand what he's wrestling with. We understand in his explanation of the mitzvot, talking about how to identify, right, a clear reason for these prohibitions to keep us far away from practices that are not quite the thing itself, but are part of the trappings, the externals. And at the same time, as we saw with his comments about the avot, grappling with the fact that they do seem to be part of our national past. I don't want to go so far as to say that idolatrous practices are in our national DNA, but they're in our national past. And there's a reckoning with it. There's a reckoning to say, well, that was then, that was necessary for then, a time in place when the avot needed to spread Hashem's name and matzeva was a perfectly acceptable way to do it. But now that it's been taken over, we need to create a separation. But I hear in there a kind of attention, navigating that tension. Okay, to close up this section of the Shi'ur, of really understanding the nature of their prohibitions through the lens of Parshanut, with two more sources to bring into the conversation. The first is the Bechor Shor, who brings in yet another reckoning with the national past. On the words Asher Sanei Hashem Elokecha, he says, Klomar, L'shem Avodah Zara, Shakadosh Baruch Hu Sonei. V'chein l'shem bama l'hakriv mishin esru habamot shemeotah sha'a sina'im. Okay, so at this moment in time, in Dvarim, to the way Moshe is telling the Jewish people to build a matzeva, that would be considered l'shem avodah zarah. But aval im ha'mid matzeva al kivurat ha'meit l'chavod, right? We still do put up a matzeva in a cemetery. And he says here, not in terms of the contemporary practice, but in terms of biblical practice, k'mo sha'asa Yaakov l'Rachel, u'la haskir shmo k'mo sha'asa Avshalom sh'ha'mid matzeva b'chayav v'kara la yad Avshalom, ולזיכרון דברים, כמו שעשו בני גד ובני רובין על הירדן, מותר. So he brings there three different types of biblical moments where people erected a matzeva, and he puts them in a different category. And he says, those weren't problematic. They were, let's say, as we see, not near a Beit Elokim. They were not close to worship. One was in a cemetery. One seems to be in time of Avshalom, a matzeva to himself, right? That's the story of Avshalom, right? Who is very arrogant. And the Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuven, who, when they set up shop in the opposite side of the Yarden, they use the matzeva as a zicharon devarim, right? A monument for posterity, a historical monument. Those are all acceptable, right? But you see here again, in the words of the Bechor Shor, this is a reckoning with, this is a way of suggesting, well, yes, matzeva in a more categorical way. If the Torah were to say, no, 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 completely nothing, if it resembles in any way idolatry, it's off the books. Well, there's a few exceptions. It's okay in this way, and it's okay in that way. Finally, we have in the words of the Sefer HaChinuch, and I'm on a kick now with the Sefer HaChinuch. I really recommend it when you're preparing the Parsha. It's very useful way of categorizing and understanding all the mitzvot in the Parsha, which in Dvarim, there's quite a lot. Good to start with Bereishit, a slow start. But Sefer HaChinuch often gives a kind of conceptual understanding of mitzvot in addition to describing the halachot. And both for Latat Ilan Bamikdash and when it comes to the matzeva, he says something which we have heard before, but it's worth hearing his words. If you look right here, shelo latat ilan bamikdash, shelo lintoa ilanot bamikdash, o etzel hamizbeach. So the mitzvah is you can't, as we know, plant trees either in the Mikdash itself or next to a Mizbeach, presumably in a time when there were Bamot and they were allowed. B'tam Yisur Zeh, Katav HaRambam Zichrono Livracha, L'fi Shekach Hayu Osim Ovdei Avodah Zarah B'batei Avodah Zarah Shelahem. Right, you can't do it, says the Rambam, who the Sefer HaChinuch is quoting, as we know, because that's what the idolaters were doing. U'kidei laharchik kol hadomeh lahem mimachshevet b'nei Adam habaim la'avodat ha'el baruch hu b'makom ha'hu hanifchar nimna'u milntoa sham kol ilan. I hear something extra in those words. He's saying it's not just you can't do it because the idolaters were doing it, but when you show up to a place of worship, the Torah is going out of its way to say, to distance anything that's even similar to what a person, a Jew, would be thinking that they've seen out there in the marketplace, that they've seen there on the streets. They shouldn't be thinking about that at all. They should be totally unified in their ability to come and worship only God in that place. So the Ilan, just to review, even if you're not concerned that you're going to be worshiping it, it's a shemetz shel. It's a reminder of, it's a proximity to the practices of the idolaters. And the Torah wants to be extra careful as best as it can to keep you away from even thinking like them, thinking about them when you're davening, when you're worshiping. The Sefer HaChinuch says, "V'nohegi sorzeh bein bischarim bein bin kevot v'afilu bazman hazeh." It's still applicable today, says the Sefer HaChinuch. Hanoteh ilan b'chol ha'azara chayav malkut. That if you or I were to try to plant a tree, Nahar Habayit, that would be a direct violation of this prohibition. Okay, and he says a similar, very similar, we don't need to read it, of shalol ha'kim atzeva, very similar way of describing the problem with that mitzvah as well. Okay. In the final section of this shiur, what I wanted to share with you was three different ideas that I found by a variety of commentators, the first one being the Gemara, which we don't typically think of as a commentator on the Tanakh. So let's say three different approaches that move us beyond thinking about what did these mitzvot mean in the context of the moment of Sefer Dvarim, beyond thinking about how to apply these mitzvot only in a cultic context, and begin the process that those of you who have studied with me before, this is what I do all the time with Sefer Vayikra, thinking about ways to extend a mitzvah, i.e. identifying a core conceptual value that the mitzvah can still teach us even when we can no longer practice it or apply it. I see the same impulse at play here in the last three sources that I want to share with you that are still talking about our two mitzvot, but are really moving beyond thinking about what was the problem for the Jews at that moment in planting an ilan or putting up a matzeva next to their mizbeach. The first extension approach comes from the Gemara itself. That's a rather famous Gemara. And the Gemara here, as we'll see in a moment, the way that it creates this extension is by thinking again about the smichut, about the series of psukim backed up against each other, which we noticed right at the beginning, which is always a good way of finding meaning from psukim. What can I learn from context? So says the Gemara, Amar Reish Lakish, Kol ha'ma'amid dayan al ha'tzibur she'eno hagun ki'ilu noteya ashera be'Yisrael. Shne'emar, shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha, v'samich le lo titan lecha ashera kolitz. Okay? Very modest comment, bare bones, we have to flesh it out. Reish Lakish says, anybody, and I would assume here we're not talking about an individual per se, but any group of people who put into power a judge who is not hagun, is not fit, presumably not wise enough, not ethical enough, not capable of taking on the responsibility of being a dayan within the Jewish community. If you do that, it is as if you planted an asherah next to a mizbeach. Why is that? Of course, because they're right next to each other. Now, what's interesting about this comment, and maybe I'll read Rav Ashi first and then tell you how I'm understanding it. Rav Ashi deepens it a little bit further and says, "Ubimakom sheyesh tamidei chachamim ki'ilu nita'o etzel mizbeach, shne'amar etzel mizbeach Hashem alokecha." I misspoke before when I added mizbeach into the first comment. Rav Ashi says, well, those extra words, etzel mizbeach, that's in a situation where you're appointing an unfit judge in a community where there's wonderful Torah learning going on, where there are talmidei chachamim. And if you position a judge who is not fit into that community, it's even worse than the first scenario. And that's why it says, etzel mizbeach, etzel mizbeach Hashem alokecha. Now, what's going on in this source? What I think that the Gemara is doing is shifting our gaze away from the strictly cultic context. The idolatry reference, the Asherah, is taken for granted. And the chidush is that a person who is put as a judge who is not fit, the effect, the pernicious effect that has on the community is just like that adjacent asherah of idolatry. Meaning, we might think that being a judge is totally about ethics and is not about theology. And the Gemara here is saying that it's both the same source. You're doing God's work when you're a judge. You're worshiping God when you're worshiping. And so if you put an unfit judge, and especially with Ravashi's comment, into a community where there's Torah going on, people generally respect judges. They assume they're doing the right thing. They assume that they are capable of the position in which they are placed. And the kind of negative effect that an unfit judge can have, not just on the immediate rulings and on the parties that are implicated by their judgments, but on the larger community, it's a very large and negative ripple effect. And the Torah is saying here, the Gemara rather is saying, you have to be so careful when you're appointing judges, and of course, if you are the judge, but the people who are appointed them have to be so careful because everybody is at risk. Everybody's at risk. Just like we saw in the early sources, if you plant that tree, other people are at risk, the ones who see the people going in. So that's the first approach here that you could argue with me. I might even argue with myself. It's a little different from the other two that come, but it begins to give us a way of looking at this mitzvah that it is not limited to, as I said, the cultic context, but is thinking a little bit more widely into the ethical. The second approach is by the Sforno. And I included here the entire section in Hebrew and in English. Yes, I did. But I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm only going to read the first part. You have it if you want to read the rest later. That gets a little funky. But the Sforno begins by linking our two mitzvot, the Asherah and the Matzevah, with the third, which we saw at the beginning of the shiur, the third about the mum. And he draws a conclusion about the proximity of these three together. And he offers an interpretation, which again moves us out of the cultic into the ethical. Says the Sforno, Hevi shlosha domim me'inyan dvarim, shehim na'im kefi hachush, v'nimasim mipnei mumam haruchani. The Torah brings three things together whose common denominator is that they appeal to the senses, they are desirable, but at the same time are all spiritually negative or harmful. Nim asim, right? Like sanei Hashem Elokecha. The first one is the Asherah. Shehi lenoi hechalot. Similar to what we saw in Ramban. The Asherah is beautiful. It beautifies buildings, and one could understand why they would want that. One could imagine why you would be sympathetic to a person who would want to build one. Umikol makom, inim eset lakodesh, mipnei shahaita tachsis laavodat gilulim. Right, the Asherah, which is beautiful, it's desirable, it appeals to your senses, is nevertheless ne'esar, it's prohibited, and it is disgusting to God, because, as he says, it's a conduit leading to idolatrous practices, which is stronger than what we saw earlier. We didn't see the other Mefarshim making that claim that this could directly lead to idolatrous practices, right? Thinking back where I began of the Aztec worshipers who were advised by their priests to go and pray in the Christian churches, they did eventually all become Christian. What they believe in their hearts, are there secret Marranos of that variety in Mexico? I don't know. But they, here the Sephorno says, the concern is that it would become a conduit l'avodat kelim. Okay, so what's the lesson? V'chein nakdim ha'adafat ha'tzedek haruchani l'shleimut guf hadayan shehu hoshi v'gishmi. He creates a different vector from the juxtaposition of the Asherah to the Dayanim. And he says, we have to learn from the Asherah that the same thing is true with judges. Don't be attracted. Don't defer to what you see on the externals of a judge. Of course, we all are. We're all biased. I'm a short person. I know that tall people project more power. We are attracted to externals, but says the Torah, you're looking in the wrong place. When it comes to Dayanim, where you need to be looking is their spiritual qualities. And we learn that from the juxtaposition. And as you'll see, if you read the whole thing, he argues that each of them, the Matzeva and the Mum, teach the same lesson. So just to recap, before we look at the last source, the Sforno, like the Gemara, is moving away from an understanding of this mitzvah, which would only be applicable in a time when a person or a community would be tempted to plant an Asherah. This is something which the quote-unquote take-home message is useful even today in the appointing of judges and, of course, in the appointing of leadership within our community. The Sephorno is encouraging us to look at this mitzvah as having a very relevant, urgent message that we all need to do better at dulling the pull of the aesthetic and sharpen our lenses and our prioritization of the inner qualities of other people and, dare I say, of ourselves. The last source or series of sources are from the Me'a Shiloach, the Ishbitzer, and I'm only at the start of understanding the Me'a Shiloach, but I want to bring whatever I got from this. I think it's very compelling. To my knowledge, he's the only one of the Hasidic writers who addresses this particular mitzvah head on. And he says something very, very interesting. The first passage here relates to the Asherah. He says, "Hainyan bazeh, af shenitztava ha'adam, shehiye kafuf, tachat tamil chacham, kimavo'ar le'el be'uvda, Rabban Gamliel v'Rabbi Yoshua, Zehu rak b'divrei Torah, aval b'tzvila, asur lihiot kafuf, tachat shum gavan ki mizbeach, or gavun ki mizbeach humakom tzvila va'avoda." I'll pause there and then continue. Says the Me'a Shiloach, what this mitzvah is teaching us is that even though when it comes to the words of Torah, one should always defer to their teacher, or to a Talmid Chacham, one should always adopt, I would say, a posture of humility and deference and understand the hierarchy when it comes to words of Torah. But with tefillah, says the Me'a Shiloach, it is prohibited liot kafuf. And as he translated, we may not defer to any outside appearance, any human trait such as honor, power, wisdom, and the like. When it comes to tefillah, there cannot be any mediators. There cannot be any comparisons. There cannot be any hierarchies. As he continues, quoting the Gemara, the halacha is asur l'adam shitpalel acholrei rabo. You can't daven behind your teacher. And he explains that. What's the reason? Because you can't have your teacher in your way. When you come to tefillah, there can't be any comparisons. There can't be any hierarchies. You cannot rely on anyone else. You cannot see yourself through anyone else. Ki b'tzfilat tzarich lahavin, ki hu mitpalel lahashem itbarach, mekor hayishua, sheyachol lahashio hoshia oto b'li gvul umeitzar. When a person comes to tzfilah, They need to come unencumbered. They need to come without anything literally in their view or in their more spiritual view. They need to be able to see themselves situated mulo rak Hashem. It's only them and God is able to save them without any limitation. To me, this is a fascinating application of the prohibition of lo titalacha asherah. As you see, it has nothing to do with the cultic context. We're far away from any concern of a mizbeach. We're not talking here about outside culture influence. We're not even talking here about a society within a society. The Me'ah Shiloach takes this mitzvah and makes it extremely personal. It is about worship, but it's about tefillah. And he uses it to explain, to give us, either you can hear it as musr or you can hear it as encouragement. But he's telling us something about fundamentally what it means to come to a moment of tefillah. There can't be anything in our way. Finally, the Me'ah Shiloach on our second mitzvah, V'lo takim lecha matzeva, he says something different. He says, Hainu, shelo yiyeh ha'adam be'akshut, bedavar af ba'avodat Hashem. The mitzvah of lo takim lecha matzeva, says the Me'ah Shiloach, teaches us that a person should not be stubborn with anything, even in avodat Hashem. I've never heard of stubbornness coming with avodat Hashem. This is a new one for me, but he says, you might think that stubbornness could be okay when it comes to avodat Hashem, but even there, it doesn't belong. And he continues and says, v'zeh perush Rashi af shechaviva haita bimei avot, ki avot hayu tikifin, v'hayu mosrin nasham af al davar katan, ki az lo haya nikar malchut Hashem itbarach ba'olam, l'ficha chayatorech hasha'al azeh. Okay, quoting Rashi, which we referred to at the beginning, Rashi, who pointed out that the Avot had erected Matzevot, remember? And Rashi there had said, right, because then it was Ahuva, but then once the Kananim took it over, it became Snu'ah. The Me'ah Shiloach says something different about that. He uses the Matzeva, this monument, in a symbolic way, it represents, right, a stubbornness, a hard, solid rock that you're willing to lay it down wherever you are. Abraham slapping down this matzivo wherever he was. He says, well, yeah, because the avot, they were tikifin, right? They had tikifut. They were incredibly strong and they were willing to be moser nefesh, even on small things. Because at that moment in time, right? Think about Abraham and when he lived and how he was spreading the idea of God before anybody knew it. So he had to be moser nefesh up and down. But today, avalata, ein limsor nefesh rako shlosha varim hayiduim. We should not be willing to lay down our life. That's what he means by moser nefesh, literally our nefesh, except for the big three, which we know about: idolatry, avodah zarah, and adultery. If you are, God forbid, told that you must do those aveirot or you'll be killed, you have to die. But nothing else, says the Me'ah Shiloach. That quality of stubbornness, of tikifut, that should be relaxed for worshipers. That level is no longer necessary in our time. That belongs to a different time. I'm sure there's a lot more to mine from that aspect of what he's saying in Avodat Hashem, but thankfully he leaves us also with an ethical. In the final line, he says, Begam romez shelo yiyeh adam ba'akshut neged chavero, shelo yomar lo shiyakabel da'ato, af shiyidmeh lo shatzedek imo. Right? This also hints that one should not be stubborn regarding his peers, so as not to tell him that he must accept his opinion, even if it seems that he is right. So he goes beyond Avodat Hashem and says that we can also learn about the stubbornness when it comes to our dealings with other people. Even if you know you're right, you gotta let it go. Stopping the share. Now I can see your faces again. So here what we see in our exploration of these two mitzvot, I hope we see that they're just a glimmer of what's in this parsha, of again, Moshe's persistent navigating of what it means to set up a people within a culture of compelling practices that they might want to draw from. And they might, and they did, if you read the rest of the Torah, you know, they drew from them. They absorbed them. It was an upward battle throughout the Tanakh to wean the people from idolatrous practices. So Moshe was 100% right that this was going to be such a difficult tension. We are lucky to live today in a time where we can be more open and tolerant, and we can learn from the people around us and not be so afraid that it's going to taint our Mesorah, and it's going to taint who we are and what we believe in. And we are also the recipients of an approach which can take these mitzvot that are speaking to another time, and we can use them to enhance our own avodat Hashem through tefillah and through our dealings with other people. And I would love to know what everybody thinks, but it's on Zoom. So if you want to meet, let me see if what's in the chat. Oh, thank you, Debbie. I will check that out. Well, these are very interesting suggestions. None of which can be addressed easily. So I'm going to leave it to that. Thank you all so much, and have a beautiful Shabbat and Chodesh Tov, and may it be a beautiful, productive, spiritually meaningful Elul for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.